you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and powered today by Geico. We've got another special episode for you today. Paranormal expert Jeff Belanger returns to Talk is Jericho, and he's got a completely different kind of story to share with us. Jeff climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Think about that. And he wrote a book about his adventure. It's titled The Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds. And Jeff details his journey up and down the mountain, what inspired him to undertake the climb, how he trained for it, and the paranormal experiences associated with Kilimanjaro. It's an incredible story. So let's pack up our bags and climb Mount Kilimanjaro with Jeff Belanger together right now on Talk is Jericho. Thanks to Geico. One of my first guests who was an expert on the paranormal is Jeff Belanger. And we've worked together on another show, which I forgot about the Bridgewater Triangle. I think we did a podcast about that too, didn't we?
We did. We did all kinds of stuff, all kinds of weirdness. So it's good to see you again, Chris.
It's awesome to talk to you and see you. And Dave Schrader from Beyond the Darkness always kind of says, hey, you should talk to this person, that person. And he goes, you should talk to this guy, Jeff, about his book about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. I'm like, well, what's he like as a guest? And he's like, you know him. I'm like, wait, I know Jeff.
Yeah, what?
Went and climbed Kilimanjaro since the last time I saw you at the Bridgewater Triangle or whatever it is, and wrote a whole book about it. So, I mean, I guess right off the bat, I mean, wow, what an experience that must have been to climb possibly the biggest mountain in the world or one of them.
Yeah, it's one of the seven summits. It's the tallest in Africa, 19,341 feet. But who's counting, right? Who's counting? Oh, man. Yeah, no, I mean, I thought about that mountain since childhood, since Toto's song Africa, right? It mentions
seriously
Kilimanjaro. Yeah. And then I went and I started hiking around college and right after college, and I loved mountains. I live in New England, so doing the White Mountains of New Hampshire and things like that, it's just great to get outdoors. That place has just been on my bucket list for years and years. And so it was a great opportunity came up to finally do it.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned Kilimanjaro being part of the song Africa. And I read that in your press release. And then, of course, like a moron, I'm like, okay, so Jeff remembers Kilimanjaro from Africa by Toto. Where is Kilimanjaro located? And then I found out, oh, it's in Africa, you dumb idiot.
Yeah.
But that's the line. I'm just looking up right now. The wild dogs cry out at night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know I must do what's right. As sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. Not exactly a squeeze me, please me type of lyrics from a rock band.
No, I don't think Fozzy. Does Fozzy cover that one yet or no?
We're actually writing an epic called Kilimanjaro. It's 14 minutes long.
Excellent. Yeah, let me know. Great. I want to hold the lighter in the video.
Yeah, exactly.
So
you've always been obsessed with Kilimanjaro since you were a kid.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you've climbed mountains prior to this?
Yeah. So, I mean, in New England, our tallest mountain is like 6,400 feet. So it's nothing compared to the big mountains like the Himalayas and stuff like that. But it's, I don't know, it's nice, especially in this digital world, to sometimes get away. But you know, as you get older, I don't know what your, I do sort of know what your 40s are like, but you know, like you get into a rut, even if your job is wicked cool. Like I know yours is,
right.
mine is too. Like it's a rut of your own design, but you're like, okay, you know, like work, do my thing, family, like repeat. And I got to do something to shake things up. That shakeup happened back in 2013 when my brother-in-law got sick with cancer. And that was just such a wake-up call. He was just a couple of years older than me. And suddenly this guy went from seemingly okay to strange stomach issues. And then he went to the doctor and they run tests and more tests. And his doctor calls him one day and says, Chris, his name was Chris too, get down here right now. Don't wait for your workday to end. Don't make an appointment. Just get down here right now. And he knows that's not good. And when he gets there, he finds out just how bad it is. They tell him, you have stage four cancer, fully metastasized tumors all over. You have 18 to 24 months to live.
Oh my gosh.
And my nephew's 3 years old at the time. And I'm just looking at that and going, holy, I mean, you know, and for the next like year plus, he went into a pretty big depression. You know, I can't say how I would be facing the same sentence, but he and I got a lot closer. I mean, we were always, you know, it was fun at family events or whatever we talk, but he's like, I know you're a paranormal guy and I'm going through something really weird. And I said, yeah, I mean, you know, death is usually pretty quick for most of us. You don't see it coming and it's over. But he really got to know it. He got intimate. And right. So he and I talked a lot. And my sister really sort of checked out of the whole thing. You know, she was just kind of in denial. She's looking at her young son, you know, he's not going to have a father. And so Chris and I talked a lot and just got closer about, because he was able to talk about that subject with me and no one else. And I learned so much from him, just like this insight he had into watching this black fog come at him for 2 years, right? 2 years is a long time and not a long time. It's simultaneously, you know? And so near the end, man, we were talking a lot and he was having these out of body experiences. He was talking about how the first time it happened, he's in the hospital and he wakes up 20 feet over his body looking down at it. And I said, what happened? He said, I'm scared of heights. I was petrified and it was over. I was right back in my body. But then it was happening every day. And by the time he got down to his final days, I went to Connecticut where he lives to see him. And it's strange, you know, when you go for a drive to a destination like that, or, you know, this isn't a visit, right? This is that big goodbye. And we talked for like 3 hours and it was one of the most enlightening conversations I've ever had in my life. I walked into his bedroom. And he's been on hospice care. He had a rented hospital bed in his room, oxygen machine, and his skin was absolutely yellow from jaundice. I know jaundice, right? His organs are failing, but the sunlight coming through the window is like hitting his body and he just looked golden. He was glowing like a golden Buddha. And he just was so at peace finally with this thing he was going through. And he told me he was having out of body experiences 3, 4, 5 times a day. And now he's seeing things. I said, what do you mean seeing things? And he said, well, the first time I saw my cat from childhood. And he said, and I didn't even like that cat. And I said, oh. Mm-hmm. And then he said, then I saw my grandma. And I was close with my grandma. I said, what do you think all this means? And he said, I think there's something inside this broken machine that's getting ready to bust out and stay out for good. And he slipped away 6 days later.
So that gave you some sort of inspiration and clarity and a sense of mortality, or
yeah, not clarity, but yeah fogginess at least.
But yeah, I got you. The opposite. Yeah,
the opposite of clarity. But it was a wake up call that, man, life is short. You know, I'm in my 40s. I think I'm in the middle of my life. You hope mm-hmm. you're in the middle, but maybe you're not. And so it was 7 months later, I was doing this paranormal event and someone said, hey, for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we got this big fundraiser, Jeff. And I was like, oh, I'll help if I can. And they said, we're going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And I was like, raise money for cancer research. Just lost my brother-in-law. Life is short. I got to do this. I have to
Toto.
Do this. Toto. I took Swahili in college 2 semesters.
What?
2 semesters of Swahili in college. I know.
Why did you take 2 semesters of Swahili?
Because my Canadian friend, my last name, Belanger, is Belanger en français. And when you take French, the teacher assumes you're fluent. I'm like, I've lived in America so long. I've lived here so long. My name's Belanger now. It wasn't even like my great grandparents changed it, you know? And so I failed. I failed French 1. And then I took Spanish and it was too close. I was confused. I was like, I need a language that's unlike any other. The friend was like, take Swahili. The professor's amazing. I'm like, where do they even speak that? Like Eastern Africa, Tanzania, Kenya, Ghana, that whole area. I'm like, cool, I'm in. And the teacher was amazing. And so, and my mom even said, she's like, when the hell are you ever going to use Swahili? Boom, 20 years later.
It was all meant to be.
It just came together in this cosmic force of amazing.
Wow. Is it, and that's the primary language in Africa, in the area of Africa that you're going to?
Yeah, in Tanzania. I spent all my time in Tanzania. Once you're on Kilimanjaro, you can look right over the edge and see into Kenya. If you're picturing Africa, the area that bulges out on the eastern side, just below the equator, Kilimanjaro straddles the border between Kenya and Tanzania. And it's
that's
a volcano.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's just one of those things. Like, I don't typically get starstruck with people, but the first time I saw this mountain in person, man, I was giddy as the day is long. It's like you're in a bar and Mark Hamill from Star Wars just walked in and you're like, ah, oh my God, it's him, right? I'm just like, there's Kilimanjaro,
right.
You know?
Right.
It's amazing, yeah.
So how exactly does that work then? You're going to go do this for charity. Do you have to train or is there some kind of protocols you have to go through and kind of fill us in on that?
Yeah. So the training was very much cardio. This is not a technical climb. You don't need ropes and hammer and spikes into walls and things like that. If you can hump your butt up a mountain, you can get there.
So it's a slow kind of incline.
6 days to the top, 2 days down, and the total trip is 42 miles of walking.
Why is it only 2 days down?
Because it's one way. There's like five different routes to get to the top, and then there's one way down for everybody. So everyone gets picked up in the same spot.
Oh, I see.
And if there's an emergency, they can get you down quickly through this one route. So they don't want people going against the grain. But yeah, and you got to pack for like all four seasons. You know, at the bottom, you're right near the equator. It's a rainforest. It's tropical. It's summer.
Wow.
And you get up above 10,000 feet and it feels like, you know, fall in Canada or New England. And then when you get to the top, there's glaciers up there. It's an Arctic tundra. So all, you know, and I'm like four seasons in 6 days. Shoot, we do that in one day in New England. We can handle that.
So tell us and Geico about the journey. Is a guide meeting you? A guide is picking you up? How does it work?
Yeah, so the training was like 6 months. We were put together with a team of people that were all doing this. None of us knew each other.
6 months.
6 months of lots of cardio, right? So this is. I mean, you got to be able to go 7-8 miles a day at higher altitudes. Altitude you can't train for unless you can get to altitude, but the rest of it you can. And so, and it's funny, I've never had such a fitness goal like this. You know, like I've exercised regularly. I'd go to the gym, I run, but you know, there's days where I'm like, I'll just do 2 miles today, or you know, I'll phone this one in. But once that was on the horizon, there was no cutting anything short. You know, I was eating better, because every time you look at that big double cheeseburger, you're like, is that going to help? I don't know. You know, and so I found everything was just getting better. So we get over there. We have guides. It's going to take literally 48 people, locals, that are going to be helping us with tents and carrying food and water. Like, everything's got to go with you. So it's almost like this whole village is moving up the mountain with us. And there was 12 of us from America that were coming to do this. And it was just this incredible thing to just get just immersed in Swahili and Africa, be like the only white people for miles and miles around and see what that feels like. See poverty like I haven't seen before. When we were in the town of Moshi, right outside of the mountain, I mean, man, their middle class would be just destitute poor over here, you know, living in a metal shack with no windows. Like, that's
right.
Middle class. And I've never felt like a rich white guy before that. You know, I've traveled around the world, but I've never felt like such a rich white guy before that moment.
You know, so I would assume that's probably kind of an industry for those people over there. They probably take six trips a year or whatever, taking Americans and foreigners up the mountain.
Yeah, no, it's everything feeds off that mountain. There's safaris that people go on, like that. The beer is Kilimanjaro beer. The tea is Kilimanjaro tea. Like, everything sort of feeds off this mountain. And when we started on the trail, we're in this rainforest, and I remember back home thinking, like, I'm going to take a picture of that first step. I'm going to take video of that monumental, like, first thing. We're like 50 yards up the trail before it even occurred to me that we've begun.
And Yeah.
I realized I was so scattered. You know how scattered my brain was. I felt guilty. This is expensive. This is a vacation my family and I could have taken with this money, but it's just me. And am I cut out for this? This whole thing, I'm missing work, email, all that. And we're walking just this incredibly slow pace through this rainforest. And then we like see monkeys. You know, there's monkeys in the trees. And I've seen monkeys before, but
yeah, man, but not like that. Yeah.
Yeah. If they want to jump on your face and rip it off, they can. They can do that. There's no stopping them. And so I was just like, whoa, I am in Africa now. And you know, we get to our first camp and it's, I would rather cut off a finger than camp. like I'll get dirty with you all day, but I want like a hot shower and a big feather bed at the end of the day. And so there's no other way, you know, and I've got this camping gear and like, this is as foreign to me as like Africa, you know? And I'm like, what do I self-inflating mattress pad? Like I'm 195 pounds. Like, how am I going to keep this off a dirt ground? And guess what? It doesn't. I don't even know what it does, but it does not keep you off the dirt ground, man. And then you're asking, you're like, am I this soft? Am I this soft? Right? Like, come on.
So our friends at Geico want to know, how are you raising money for charity and doing this?
Well, I reached out to my buddy, Chris Jericho, for one, and said, can you retweet this? And he did. So that was nice of him.
Oh,
so,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, you did. Thank you. Yeah. So it was just social media.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was just putting the word out there. People donated directly to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and we had to raise $1,000 minimum. And I think I raised north of 17,000, which was
great.
Yeah, it was awesome. People were so generous. And I'll tell you too, I printed out a list of every donor and how motivating it is when you are doing something athletic like that. Every night in my tent, I would look, I had over 300 donors. Some people donated $5, some people donated hundreds. And I looked at every name and I was just like, I don't want to let anyone down. And I got the idea because I had heard about a marathon runner, big guy who's, you'd look at him and you wouldn't think marathon. And he would write 26 names on his arm for every mile. And so if he was really struggling with like mile 7, he'd look down at number 7 and be like, I don't want to let my friend so-and-so down or my family member so-and-so. And I was thinking about like, how do you motivate yourself when you're trying to do something that, you know, you haven't done before, especially something this big. And that was one of the ways I did it.
So when you meet the other 12 people, they're all from just different parts of the country. And they're all, you guys are meeting for the first time on this base of the mountain.
Yeah. 5 of us met in New England and trained together. But the rest, 6 were from California. 1 was from New Jersey. So we all just met in Tanzania and we were just going to be cohabitating for 8 days. But it was amazing, man. Once you get above the tree line and it's so quiet, there's no pollution, there's no light pollution, there's no sound, there's no trains or cars or anything you can even hear. Jets don't fly overhead. There's too much turbulence over the mountain. It's so quiet. There's no bugs. There's no animals once you get to a certain height. And I've never in my life can recall just like that, this peacefulness that comes over. Like you get broken down to something so simple, right? You eat, you sleep, you walk, you get to the next camp, bodily functions become a really big part of your day, you know? And you're just like, it's just, life got so simple. There's no cell phone anymore and it's okay. You know, everything will just, the world will go on and it'll just have to wait for me till we get off this thing. And that was something that I kind of didn't see coming, was finding some inner quiet for the first time. And I don't even remember how long.
Well, because you have a daughter and you have a wife, right?
Yep.
So was that kind of weird being completely, because in your book, you mentioned just being completely disconnected from the world. You know, so like you mentioned right there, social media, checking out. Was that ever an issue where like you can't talk to your family at all?
For the first 2 days, I struggled with it. Like, and that was, I just kept thinking, oh, are they okay? If there's an emergency, there's nothing you can do. Nothing. This is it until I get off this mountain, and nothing I can do if there's an emergency. The good news is I told my family back home, silence equals good. So if your phone isn't ringing, everything's fine, right?
Right, right, right.
From my end, you know, from your end, please just be okay. You know, take care of everything.
Exactly, right, exactly.
And that's hard. You know, I know you travel a lot and sometimes you're on the other side of the planet. And it's not like if something really goes down, it could take you a day or more to get home. And that's going as fast as possible, you know?
And that's just when you're within your own country.
Right. Yeah.
Never mind being halfway across the world, right?
Yeah. So that was a real stressor for me because I've traveled for work plenty, but there was always like, well, if I had to, I'd go to the airport right now, I'd get on the next flight, I'd be home in hours, you know, whatever. I would figure it out. But this was a whole other deal. But after a couple of days, I just started to feel like, all right, you know what, I'm where I need to be right now. I don't know. The mountain, I think, is like the opposite of a rut. You know, when your life feels like a rut, a mountain that's down and a mountain is up.
Right.
And just kind of getting quiet and realizing, you know, when you're up that high, you'd see a couple of things like these pretty little flowers and things like that. And I was looking at it, I'm like, man, that takes grit to survive up here for anything to be here. And then I was like, wait a minute, I have grit. I'm here, you know, I'm making it. And that grit, you know, you know you have that grit when you're in your 20s and you're trying to make your rent and sleeping on your friend's couch and your car's busted, right? You got to like have grit to get to the next day. But once your life gets a little comfortable, you forget that it's even in you. And it was sort of, that was a great rediscovery too, was just to be like, all right, I still got it. I may not play in the NFL, but I can handle this mountain and I'm doing it, you know, I'm handling it.
I think one of the most interesting things about it is that you are, like you mentioned, you're just walking and starting off in the forest and kind of moving up where it's not like I saw a movie, a documentary, I'm sure you saw it, where the guy was actually climbing up the side of the mountain. You know what I mean?
Free solo.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So you are just basically walking and walking and walking. So what's the next level? You said once you get past the tree line, it's very calm. What comes after that?
So once you're around 10,000 feet, that's not so bad. I mean, if you're not sprinting, you're breathing okay. Once you get to like 12, 13, 14,000 feet, breathing becomes something you're highly aware of.
Yeah.
If you're standing perfectly still, it's not so bad. But if you got to carry your pack and go uphill, I mean, something at sea level that's no big deal is suddenly a very big deal. And you got to go way slower than feels natural. The analogy I like to use is, you know, those little stirring straws you get at the diner for your coffee?
Yeah.
Just put that in your mouth and breathe through that. Now go for a jog and just try to get enough air through that teeny little straw.
Right.
And that's what it's like. You know, you're just like, there's not enough air coming in. But once we get up higher and higher, once we get to like the base camp, two people of the 12 had to turn back. They couldn't handle the altitude.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was something. We see plaques where people have died, where this marking, you know, where people have passed away in some cases from the altitude, in one case from a lightning strike. And I'm like, lightning? Oh, man, like that hadn't even occurred to me, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I got all this metal, I got batteries and cameras and metal poles. And, you know, what do you do? We're in the clouds, man. You're walking along and it's clear. And then a cloud goes right through you because you're at 12,000, 13,000 feet. And I'm like, if that thing is gray and electric, what do you even do? And our guide said, you drop your pack and you hide behind a rock. I'm like, oh, good. Well, you know, now I have a plan.
Right? Yeah.
So that thankfully we didn't need, but the night of the summit, that's where like it just went from like a walk in a park to really real. And we have to leave at midnight to get to the summit. It's only 3 miles up, but it's going to take 8 hours to get up there for sunrise. And then we got to get back down. And when I woke up that night out of my tent and I had layers on and I'm used to the cold, man, I was the coldest I've ever been in my life. And we start going, and the difference between 15 and 16,000 feet is exponential. Like 8 to 9,000 feet, man, not so much. But once you get 15 to 16, 16 to 17, like you're very aware that all the oxygen molecules are below you now. Like there's just, you're fighting for them at this point. And it's like 3 a.m. and it's pitch dark. We have on headlamps. I can just see like this little glowing tan world around my feet. And you don't even know how you could take the next step. And I'm like, how do I get this close and not, and turn back? Like, how do I go back and tell my family I made it to like 18,000 feet? And then you see another plaque where someone died and you go, oh, geez, but I don't want to die up here either.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like 4:35 in the morning and I turn around and to the east, like there's just this little sliver of light way out on the horizon. And I realize the sun's coming up and I'm like, all right, just get to the sunrise. And you just push ahead and you follow your guide's feet in front of you. And it's just so slow, but any faster and you just can't breathe. And finally, it's 6:30 in the morning. We get just to the rim of the volcano and I turn around and the sun just broke through the clouds. And I remember feeling so many things all at once. So number one, the Maasai and the Chaga people who live around the mountain have a word for the top, and it's the house of God. It's completely a foreign land to them. And only those that God deems worthy are allowed up. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, that sunrise hits you, this sunrise, this thing that's happened every day for billions of years, like it hit me. And I felt the presence of this thing, this creator, God, spirit, whatever you want to call it. And I felt my brother-in-law, Chris, standing next to me. And I laughed, I cried, like every emotion poured out. I felt judged and I felt that I was deemed worthy. And it was like the defining moment of my 40s, right? Because in this moment, I was like, you know what? The summit's still another 500 vertical feet, another half mile away. It's a done deal. Like, mm-hmm. This is happening now. Like, now it's just finish it. And that was, it was, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the sunrise, and I'll never forget that feeling right there. That was even better than the summit. The summit was just like getting the trophy after the game, you know?
Right.
But that was the moment.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
All right, Jeff, here's a question, another one from our friends at Geico. What did you carry up the mountain, and what was in your backpack for this journey?
That was kind of a cool thing too, and that took me days to realize I had what I needed. You know, I had water, I had some snacks, I had a rain shell, I had a couple more layers. I had pictures of my family. I had pictures of my brother-in-law, Chris, and my nephew,
right?
A list of my donors. And that was about it. You know, you carry only what you need. My cameras, I was taking a lot of pictures, you know, and I've been such a goal-oriented guy for so long. You know, I was just like, get to the top, that you miss so much along the way. And trying to be a better photographer made me sort of stop and appreciate these moments, you know, like the light would change, the clouds would move, and you'd go, oh, look at that, you know, and you just want to capture every moment of it. But there was also a big realization when we did get to that summit sign, when you finally touch it, 19,341 feet, you touch it and you go, dear God, this is the halfway point. So tired, can't breathe, and you go, oh no, this is halfway, we got to get down, I got to get home, like this is where the journey home starts.
Right. You know, it's interesting because you would go through so many different emotions, because not just, let me try and phrase this properly, not just because of what you're going through physically, but also mentally as well. That to me seems, it's one of the few things where climate is changing, physical feeling, you mentioned the temperature change, but also slowly unlocking from what you're used to thinking mentally into now it's just one step in front of the other, rather than worrying about this entire other world that you kind of left behind.
It was enlightening. And I feel like at the top, the analogy I use is like, it's like a picture was taken, but it's a black and white line drawing. And it would take literally weeks, maybe even months, for that drawing to fill in with colors and sharpness. Something happened up there. And I feel like I came home a better man. Number one, a guy who knows I can climb Mount Kilimanjaro, that I can still do some big stuff, physical stuff in my midlife here. And, you know, you get chewed out by your boss or something, and you're just like, yeah, okay, well, I could still climb Mount Kilimanjaro. You know, like,
yeah.
I get to keep that one, right? Like, that's a thing I get to keep. And just getting away from it all and getting that high up, like I gained so much perspective on myself, right? Like that inner kid felt like he was still in there somewhere. Haven't heard from him in years, but like somewhere in there, I felt like he woke up a little bit and he's like, hey, climb that rock just because it looks like fun, you know? And let's just do what humans do. And it was just so incredible to get back to something like that. And I'm the kind of guy to has to process it. Like, I started writing it down when I got home. I mean, I wrote for a year, just draft after draft, just processing it through words, what it really meant to me. And you know, what I love about the mountain is like, it's the ultimate metaphor. You know, anything can be a mountain. Getting over a breakup, getting a new job, you know, dealing with like cancer in your life or someone you care about, whatever. Like, those are all mountains that we have to climb. But like, this was a mountain that I chose to climb, that I put in my way on purpose. And I got to remind myself that we do have to put mountains in our way now and then, just to show ourselves we still have that grit.
Another question from our Geico pals: as you start getting further and further up the mountain, what's it like for your oxygen levels and breathing and all that sort of thing?
So they test us every day, twice a day. They're testing oxygen levels, your vitals, all that stuff. You just don't know how you can handle altitude till you get there. You can't train for it. I mean, they make these masks that give you a little less air, but it's just not the same. I mean, at some point I felt drunk, and not the fun drunk. I mean, when you're 17,000-18,000 feet, I dropped a glove at my, just right at my feet, and I bent over to pick it up, and I stood up and I just went, oh man, like that took everything out of me. Just that simple thing At some point I was trying to zip up my jacket after stopping to pee, and like, I couldn't get my zipper together. And there's nothing wrong with it. I just didn't have the coordination to just get these two things together and zip it up. And one of our guides had to come over, and I felt like a child. He was just like, zip, you know, and it was one of those things where you feel just out of your body. And by the time we get up to those higher altitudes, it's like, you're a wet towel that's just been totally wrung out, you know, like everything's squeezed out of you. And I know you're an athlete, you know how that feels like. I mean, it's good. It's good for the soul, right? To get it's good for your body, but it's good for your soul to get that squeezed out where you're like, it is all out of me right now. And you know that, like, I'm at a point in my life where, like, you know, it occurred to me, like, I'm not going to play professional sports. You know, no one enters like baseball or the NFL at this age. Like, But what can I still do? And like, this was something I could do. And it was like really, I don't know, empowering, you know, to be like, I still got it. I'm not, I don't have a foot in the grave yet. And that's one of the things I definitely got to bring home.
There's a great story in your book where you're feeling happy and you start singing Spice Girls and then pay the price where you can't breathe for the next 3 hours or whatever it is.
It was out of nowhere. We're like, myself and one of the girls from California, we just broke into like Wannabe, you know, like If You Wanna Be, and just being a goof and just, go ahead. Like, you know, 20 seconds of that, and you're like, go without us. Just go. We'll catch up. You know, it's just, but literally, I mean, that just one verse of the Spice Girls took 20 minutes of delay, you know, I mean,
right.
No one tells you that. No one tells you that. It was really something to realize just how precious that is, you know, air and breathing and focusing.
So my question is, like, you mentioned there's 12 of you plus there's, you know, 48 people in the camp or whatever it may be, or 48 people helping you up the mountain.
Yeah.
What happens if someone starts to lag and slows down? Like, is this one long chain of people, or do you stop and wait for the next, or how does that kind of go?
Yeah. So, you know, we go from one camp to another each day. And so if someone's fallen way behind, there's a guide or two that hangs back with them. No one's like, good luck. You know, the monkeys are going to rip your face off.
Yeah,
good
see
luck.
You later.
So, you know, but we try to mostly stick together. And that's the cool thing too, is until we get to summit day, it's just, you just got to get to the next camp. That's all. Get there before the sun goes down. Everything's fine. But it gets a little hairy once we're going for the summit, because you've got to get up there, and then we got to get down, and then we got to get down to the next camp. It's just a grueling, like, I don't know, 30, 40 hours with very little sleep and a whole lot of movement at really high altitude. And that was that wrung out feeling that we had, but amazing.
So when you get to the summit, how long do you stay there for? Our friends at Geico think you just touch the top and start going down again?
8-9 minutes. I had pictures to take, and everybody gets their pictures, and it's really exciting. But
that's it, that quick.
That's it. And but that's, there's no air up there, man. You got to get down.
Gotcha.
You know? And so, yeah, it's like, take your picture, and then what else are you going to do? You're not going to plant a garden, right? It's not going to just get out of here. And so the other thing too was really cool. At the top, you could see the glaciers. There's been glaciers up there for thousands of years.
Jeez.
And it's predicted that they're going to be gone within about 10 years because of climate change. And so that was kind of incredible to see these majestic things that have been there for thousands of years and steadily shrinking, and to think, wow, I could be one of the last to actually see it in person. So that was, and then, you know, get down. And when you come down, funny thing, right? So coming down a mountain is always harder. There's a life lesson there somewhere, right? right? It's always harder coming down. But at the same time, you come down 500 feet and there's more air, 500 more feet. And that straw you're breathing through gets just a little thicker. And you're like, okay, a little more air. And further down and further down until you're just like, hey, this isn't bad at all. And you don't have to go quite as slow coming down, but it's all impact on your ankles and on your knees. And that's, you know, going up is just muscle. You get tired, just rest for a minute and keep going. But down is that impact. And so it's just sort of like pacing yourself. And then also realizing, like, shoot, man, you're on the decline now. That thing you've been thinking about for so long, you just did it. And now what? What's your next thing? Like, it was weird. I had a hangover for like 3 months, just like, what's my next thing? What am I going to do now? Like, I thought about this for so long. I trained hard for it.
Right.
And that's, I mean, you know, how do you stay motivated? How do you stay motivated to like get the next thing?
It's not the same, but it kind of is. Like when I did Dance with the Stars, for example, you spend so much time training and practicing and doing it, and it's every day, boom, 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 boom. After 7 weeks when it was done, I felt super lost. Like, what am I going to do? Like, where's my dancing? You know, so I could see you kind of having the same thing mentally and physically when you're taking all this time to get up there. You know, once you get up there, you start going down, you're probably like, whoa, now what? You know, it's done.
And that's the thing that, but you do a million different things. Like, you found something after Dancing with the Stars.
You have to.
And not only that, I mean, let's be honest, you want to chase that high again.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. You want to be like, okay, well, it doesn't have to be a mountain per se, but what's the next thing I want to do that's going to get me this excited, this focused again, and, like, you know, to set this big goal and get there. And that's the difference between like champions, you know, and like, how does Tom Brady win six and then
seven Super Bowls?
Like, right. How do you motivate for eight? Like, you have more than anyone is ever going to get, you know.
Yeah.
But he does, and I think there's, you know, we look to our athletes for inspiration with this stuff, because you're just like, yeah, how do I stay motivated? How do I come back after something really cool like that and find my next really cool thing? And that's the job for all of us.
Okay, this one's for Geico. Going back to when you were in those higher elevations, first of all, you must have had to take in so many calories to have that energy. What do you eat when you're up there, and how do you eat when you're up there?
So those 48 people, they don't go all the way to the top with you. They just get to the last camp, and then you have a few guides that get you up there. They're carrying food. We ate a lot of rice, lots and lots of rice, a lot of plantains, which are like those green bananas. When you eat them that green, they taste like a potato. So lots of starch, lots of rice. They had pasta. You can never eat enough. So whatever was put in front of me, I ate. We had sandwiches and chicken and stuff like that.
Is it hot? Is it cold?
Yeah, they brought up propane tanks to heat things up. So yeah, so we were able to eat hot meals and even soups. They were incredible. You know, my expectations were so low with food. I was picturing just granola bars, you know, every meal. But no, they took care of us. And what's great when you're doing something like that is you can eat all you want. You're not watching any calories at that point.
Right.
You just take it all in and burn it the next day. So yeah, we ate okay. And the bathroom, that was the tricky part, right?
Talk about that.
Yeah, so the guides were, they called it picking a flower, which I think is just charming. You know, so you're walking along, and when you're at the lower elevations, picking a flower is easy. There's tons of trees. You can go by in any one of them and have all the privacy you'd like. Once you get above the tree line, there's just nothing but rocks. Some of them are big enough to hide behind it. And you realize we all just kind of give each other as much dignity as we can give, you know?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, man, it's easier for boys, obviously. But when you got to go number two, man, you're just digging a hole, sitting behind a rock and just thinking, my life has come to this. You know? And that's where you're at. That's what you got to do.
And that's literally just digging a hole in the ground.
And that, if you're in the middle on the way. At our camp, they had those little squatty potties in a little tent. Again, everybody knows what you're doing, but at least you've got that.
Who cares, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's gone. At this point, you're just like, look, you know, the pride has got to be left somewhere down below.
Yeah.
We'll get that back when we get off the mountain.
Leave the pride with the cell phone.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is cool too, just to be like broken down, like, you know, bodily functions, food, sleep, like these are the biggest things to think about during the day. Those are your top concerns.
I would imagine too, not getting too biological about it, but I would imagine that you're using up so much of the food you're eating. There's probably not a lot of waste even there.
Or is there? I didn't take any pictures for you, Chris, but
give us some documentation. there has to be an app for that.
There was plenty. Yeah, man, I don't know. It was a really cool like fitness thing. And also you know, a way to like honor someone you care about and yourself to realize like, wow, you know, like still capable. Yeah.
No, I guess too, like I noticed like whenever I go, you know, I love going snowboarding every year for basically a lesser version of what you're saying. Like when you get on top of the mountain, the peacefulness, the lack of noise, the lack of industrial noises, just that kind of being one with nature, not to get too, you know, philosophical about it. Did you feel that as well? Like I'm one with Mother Nature?
The second night, we were on the mountain. We were at this place called Shira Plateau, and it was just flat and open. And when the sun went down, there was not a single cloud in the sky. And I have never in my life seen a starry sky like that before.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, like the Milky Way is just right there. And every single star, the Southern Cross, the like all these constellations I don't get to see because I'm up in the Northern Hemisphere. Like it was, there was no light pollution, no pollution. If you just tilt your head up, like I was in space. I mean, I was yeah. in space and it was incredible to just feel this like, It's so great to be on a mountain that big and feel that small and just be okay with it. And it is philosophical. I mean, you do start to like get one with this place that you are because you have to. You're in this like symbiotic relationship with it for the next week. You got to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And just to notice details about this place was just, you know, I have a daughter. I know you do too, right? I mean,
yeah,
so,
two of them, yeah.
Yeah, two, right. So at one point near the top, there was like, all these broken rocks. It looked like if you took like 10,000 dinner plates and shattered them. And I took a picture of it for my daughter specifically because I was like, you know, looking at this mountain from a distance or up close, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. But it's been here for 1 million years.
Jeez, right.
And it's pocked up and it's been weathered and it's been broken and battered and bruised and been through volcanoes. And it is still one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And it's beautiful because it's taken all this abuse and battering and it still stands tall after all this time. And it was like this lesson for my daughter, you know, like, look at this place. Like, this is what beauty looks like, that you're going to get scars and you're going to get pocked up because that's what happens over time. But you stand tall. And it felt like a lesson for her, too.
Another interesting part is when you were walking up the mountain and you see kind of almost a memorial gravestone kind of on the side of it. That must have been kind of a little bit of a shocker for you to kind of see that just sitting right there.
Sobering, yeah. To say the least, because you're like, hey, this is great. This is fun. And then we passed at least two where you look and you say, someone died right here. Someone came back with this plaque to leave
right
here. Yeah, like this was like a return trip for someone. And that was sobering. And you know, the dates on it, one of them, I think, was like 2013. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago. It's not
like— What year did you climb?
2017.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, it had only been a few years earlier. And to look down at that, and, you know, one of the other interesting things about the Chaga people, and the Chaga are like more on the Tanzania side. So the Chaga people have this belief that our world and the spirit world are completely interconnected, that one can affect the other just as easily as like living people can affect each other. You can make someone angry, they can make you angry or happy or anything. And so the idea that someone dies and is still with us on the mountain is just accepted. It's not that unusual. And that person maybe could help us and maybe could not help us depending on their mood. And I thought that's really an interesting way to look at not just the physical world, but like the whole notion of this afterlife as well, that you still matter even when your material body has passed on and you still have influence. Sort of comforting.
Right. Yeah, for sure. What did those guys die from, by the way? Like, how do you die on the mountain?
So the second one we saw was altitude. And it can cause an aneurysm. It can cause all kinds of things. Once you get up high enough, you can just asphyxiate. You can not get enough air. You can push yourself too hard and it can cause cardiac arrest, any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
The first plaque we saw, he was struck by lightning. That's how he died.
Wow.
I know. Yeah. And that's when it just, you have this like wake up call, like, yeah, I've got all this metal on me and oh man, like, and these clouds, you know, you're walking along and like this puffy cloud will just go like right through you. And you're like, that's kind of neat. I'm right at their altitude. And some of them are sort of gray in color. And you go, well, shoot, if there's enough of them and they're electric, that's a big problem. You know, I mean, fast. It, the weather changes so fast. I mean, these clouds roll in, they move out. It can happen. And 1 minute it's sunny and you're walking and the next minute you're in a cloud. And that happened over and over. So that was sort of a wake up call too. But also the volcano is only dormant. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, if this thing goes off, that's checkout time. Don't even run. There's no point. You know, like
right.
Why? You might as well watch it coming. So that occurred to me too, that this is not an extinct volcano. It's just a dormant one.
Mm. All right. Our friends at Geico reminded me about this. So you're a paranormal expert, so to speak. Was there any type of paranormal activity associated with Kilimanjaro?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the local people have a word for the top of the mountain. That's the house of God, where God dwells. And if you think about this too, if you live down near the base of the mountain where people have lived for countless thousands of years, it's white at the top of that mountain because of snow. It snows regularly. And you've never seen snow, not at Tanzania, not at the base. So it's just so foreign to you, so completely out of reach. And I can understand why they would say, you know, and don't go up there. There's nothing for you. There's no food. There's no water. There's nothing, no resources. There's no reason to go up there. And yet mountains just call to some people. They just do. There's also something interesting about, especially on the Kenyan side, about elephants. How when elephants are getting ready to die, some of them will go thousands of feet up that mountain and pass away on the mountain.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, why, right? When you sense you're near the end of your life, this elephant will do that. And people have seen like elephant bones and things like that at 8 or 9 or 10,000 feet. And that's, I mean, I know what it took to get me up that high. And, you know, elephants, a lot more mass and all that other stuff. So there's something mystical and magical about this place that it even calls to the elephants to go up there to pass away. When I was on the rim of the volcano, I did have that moment where I felt my brother-in-law, who, by the way, like in life, this would be the very last trip he would ever, like he would never be the guy that climbs Mount Kilimanjaro. Mm-hmm. That's just not who he was. But I felt him there. I felt him like right there with me. And it was kind of cool to feel that connection. And I thought about like what the Chaga people believe, that, you know, you call what and who you need when you need it. And I guess in that moment, I needed to know he was still there.
Mm.
So when you do finally get back down to the bottom, do you get like a plaque, a medal, I climbed Kilimanjaro, all I got was this t-shirt.
Yeah, right. So they gave us a certificate that said the day we did it and the time. I still have that somewhere. I took a picture of it. We had a lot of beer. The Kilimanjaro beers are these 20-ounce bombers, and they're $1 each. I don't know how many $20 buys, but it's a lot. I think it's about 12.
right.
And at that point, you just float off to bed. So yeah, there was a lot of like drinking and eating that day after, and the shower. Oh, the shower.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was the first shower in 8 days plus. And you know, that was, I thought it would feel so glorious. It felt like work. Like there was some scrubbing to do, you know, but it was just kind of crazy to just be stepping back into the world after that and get connected, call home. Everybody's right. Okay. Yeah. Got away with it. Everybody's okay. Everybody's safe. Great. I'll be on my way home tomorrow. You know, see you soon. You know, to just, that was, of course, felt good to feel that connection with home again and start getting some pictures over through the hotel Wi-Fi and be like, look at what I saw. I can't wait to tell you about it. And that's what made it real, right? Was to ultimately get home and realize, and it took me all the way to getting home, that the goal was never the top. I thought it was. I thought the summit was the goal, but the goal is to get home, right? Like that's where the adventures start and that's where they end. Is when you bring them back to where you live. And that was cool. That was really cool to have that moment and realize that this is the goal. This is where I was heading the whole time.
Do you kind of lament the state of the world being so connected with phones and everything when you saw the other side completely, a total 180 from where we're at here in civilization?
And they both have their charm. Let's be honest, right? Like, I don't want to be too far from that technology because I like connecting with people and I like sharing my stories and I like being able to do this stuff. So, but it was a great reminder that there is a whole other way of life that humans have gone through all up until like the last, 50, 60 years ago, right? Like, it wasn't that long ago in human timeline that it was, you know, your whole world was like the town you lived in. That was just, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
Yeah.
You didn't venture too far beyond your town's borders. But that's not the world we live in anymore. It's a reminder to go visit that world, that simple world, and to reset myself again. I'll still do day hikes and stuff like that and do some mountains around here. And it's resetting to a point, but it's not the same as like just really unplugging, not looking at a TV or a computer screen or a phone screen for that long. But it is a reminder to do it again, get reset again, And then you come back and you're ready for another round.
Would you do something like this again?
I would do Kilimanjaro again tomorrow. If you're like, really? I got a ticket, let's go. I would go again. And I'm the kind of guy, I love to travel. I love seeing foreign places, but I typically don't want to go to the same place twice for no other reason than like I went to Machu Picchu two summers ago. It was great. But like, if you said, hey, I got a ticket, you want to go? I've been there. It's great. Peru, beautiful, loved it. But, you know, I've been there and done that. What's the next thing? But Kilimanjaro, I would go again. And, you know, there's the seven summits. The tallest, of course, is Everest. But there's another one I'm sort of thinking about. There's Elbrus over in Europe, and that's the tallest. That's one of the seven as well. And so I'm like, and that's also not a technical climb. And you start itching again. You're like, I could knock out two of the seven. I mean, that's that's sort of bragging rights, right?
Right.
Something.
One last question from the folks at Geico. What's the thing that stands out the most for you, Jeff? Like, what's the big moment from this journey for you?
There's two, right? Seeing the sunrise and finding like this sense of hope again. That just a few hours earlier, I was just in literally the darkest, coldest place I'd ever been, and feeling like I was going to have to quit, to invigorated and knowing like I matter, I'm here, I made it, and now we're going to do it. But also the takeaway of getting this whole experience, you know, that this thing is now a part of me forever, and I get to keep it. It's not a material thing; it's an experiential thing that gets to remain part of me. And so knowing I can do it, knowing that I have the ability to do that, that I can get myself in the kind of shape to do it, fitness wise, that's just so comforting. And I know for a fact, the type of life I have, I mean, I'm a researcher, I'm a writer, I'm at my computer a lot. I get to travel, which is cool, but like, I just don't have the physical challenges that I wish I did. And I got to make those things. I got to make time for those things because they're not built into my life.
I mean, last question for you. And it's interesting because you've been known for being kind of the paranormal guy and the New England guy and all that sort of stuff. Now that you have experienced this other life-changing event, do you now want to spread your career, so to speak, or do you want to go back to Ghost Guy, or is there other adventures that you want to have?
I still love ghosts. I will still be the paranormal guy, I promise. I'm still doing my weekly podcast, New England Legends, still doing like all the stuff that I love doing. That doesn't change. In fact, I viewed this as almost an extension of that, right? When you spend enough time in like haunted castles and graveyards and battlefields, you realize this is sort of a spiritual journey too.
Exactly. Sure.
Yeah. And like, I have my own questions just like everybody else. So, you know, when I'm in that old abandoned hospital looking for ghosts, what I'm really asking is like, is there something beyond? Is there this thing? And so this was a way for me to also express my spirituality, to have a deeply spiritual experience in a profound place. So yeah, no, I mean, I want to be both guys, and I think I am. And my book, right? It's got out of body experiences in it. It's got this spiritual encounter at the top. Like, that's the lens that I look through. I can't help it. That's who I am, and that's not going to change. But at the same time, I do have other things I want to see, experience, and do. And I'm just grateful that I have the chance to do that and share those stories as well.
I mean, it's obviously a legit spiritual experience. Like you said, to do something like that and to be one with nature, I mean, that is spiritual for sure. You know, you don't have to see the white sheet flying through the sky to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Is there another adventure that you want to take?
So I have this idea. I want to get a group of friends together, and I want to go into the Sierra Nevadas, and I want to rent a gold mine claim, and I want to spend a week digging for gold. Like, it's 1849. Like, I spoke to a guy while I was working for Ghost Adventures. I still do. I spoke to a guy who had a ghost experience at an old abandoned mine, and he's like, "Oh, my buddies and I, we spend 2 weeks a year and we rent claims, and we found like 20 grand 1 year." And I love the idea of those in 1849, right? Like, you're 22 years old, you go out west with a shovel and a dream, and some people like got filthy rich in the span of weeks. They found a bunch of gold. And so I love this idea of like getting some friends together around the same age, and we just go live like it's 1849. I'll have to find a guide because I wouldn't know gold from granite, but whatever. We'll find someone who does and bring them along and, eat the beans out of the can and bring the whiskey and like dig for gold all day long. And if we don't find anything, I feel like it would still be some lesson in there somewhere. So that's kind of in the works.
I have done that before. I think it was for Discovery or History Channel. was a one. It was a one-off where we went. We went to Utah, like the outskirt deserts of Utah, and searched for the missing gold of Billy the Kid. And you talk about in your book about going and seeing some of these places where it looks like C-3PO and R2-D2 with the Jawas. This is the exact same thing. So, and there's stuff out there all over the place. Like, you, we found some bullets, and we found a cave that had some Billy the Kid scratched in it underneath where he was hiding. Like, there's a bunch of stuff out there that you can find.
That's really cool. And isn't that great, though? Like, we want to connect, right? We love that sense of adventure, that we're searching for something. And when it's something physical, like the top of a mountain and a summit sign, or gold, or, you know, an artifact related to someone who, you know, left a mark on the world, like that quest is really what matters, right? It's the journey.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we know that, but damn it, it feels good to cross the finish line too and find that thing and come back and be like, look it, I can hold it, I did it. But yeah, that's I get it. I get that need to seek, but also to find.
Well, Jeff, you found a great adventure in the Call of Kilimanjaro. It's a really cool story about this. And it's great to work with you, quote unquote, again. We'll have to do another show again soon.
Anytime, man. Good to see you again, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, remember, and I'm talking to you too, Geico, pick up a copy of Jeff's book, The Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy books, and go do it now.